Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
We have a poem here. It's called Whitey on the Moon. It was inspired by some whiteys on the moon. So I want to give credit where credit is due. A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon. I wonder why he's upping me, 'cause Whitey's on the moon. Well, I was already giving him 50 a week, and now Whitey's on the moon. Taxes taking my whole damn check. The junkies make me a nervous wreck. The price of food is going up. And as if all that crap wasn't enough, a rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the moon. Her face and arms began to swell, and Whitey's on the moon. Was all that money I made last year for Whitey on the moon? How come I ain't got no money here? Whitey's on the moon. You know, I just about had my fill of Whitey on the moon. I think I'll send these doctor bills, air mail special. To Whitey on the Moon.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 23rd, 2017, so I have been told. Gil Scott Heron, Whitey on the Moon, will be mentioned in the text this week. This is our third study session on the autobiography, The Last Holiday, a memoir written by Gil Scott Heron. We're picking up chapter 12. We left off last week. A really kind of tragic cliffhanger. Young Gil Scott Heron is on his way to his committee meeting to find out whether he's going to go to this new spiffy white school. And as he's leaving that morning, finds out that his mother is sick and she's going to the hospital. So that is his state of mind going to this meeting that is, you know, going to have such an impact on his childhood and his academic development. And, you know, he does not know what the state of his mom's mental health is going into the meeting. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Hopefully folks will take great notes. Be attentive, have great questions, observations. Again, context of white supremacy, Gil Scott Heron, The Last Holiday, a memoir, audio segment number one. I heard the doorbell buzz and click open as I reached the first floor, and I recognized my mother's harried, hurried, horrid doctor as he came in with his shirt sleeves rolled halfway up, his wrinkled striped tie hanging limp and off center, and his forehead sweating. He frowned and sniffed, acidosis, as if answering a question from me. Then he hurried past me and up the stairs. Soon I was scurrying onto a bus, clattering across the 207th Street Bridge and switching to the Broadway train in Manhattan. I was heading to a committee meeting, and my mother was sick. I had not been in the administration building during my campus visit, but I had passed by it at the top of the long, curved driveway that led onto Fieldston's campus. There was only a sprinkling of youngsters rushing across the quadrangle as I entered the administration building. I went upstairs to the designated floor where the principal's office door was. A smiling secretary nodded me through another door. Inside were roughly a half dozen jacketed gentlemen and one lady in a smart business suit, all standing at a long serving table. There were thin cookies on china plates. There were dainty china cups, a sturdy sterling tray supporting a sweating silver coffee pot, and a slightly smaller pot of hot water. There were tea bags, lemon wedges, sugar, packets of saccharin, instant creamer, a small bowl with cream, and an unopened pint of half and half. To my right, chairs sat in a half circle facing a solitary chair that sat isolated with its back to the wall. I was just about to get disruptive when Professor Heller rushed in from behind me and clapped me on the back as a greeting. He was wearing the same jacket he'd had on at Howard Johnson's, with elbow patches, and his glasses had a strip of tape on one hinge. He hustled past me and began glad-handing the others, all white, all prosperous-looking, all obviously executives or administrators. Soon I was sitting in that center chair facing the folks Professor Heller called the committee, meaning the committee that decided who got in. I was flattered that I got to see them, and I didn't know enough to be intimidated. I wasn't disrespectful. That wasn't in my nature. Besides, I assumed that since I had failed the test, I was only there because A. Professor Heller recommended me, B. they would like to have a reason other than a poor test score to reject Professor Heller's choice, and this could be it, and C. I had asked for it. So no matter things that I might sense, I need to be civil in my own defense. Sitting in front of these folks seems silly, but I owe it to the professor to stay chilly. If this is judgment day, more's the pity that I have to come in here before this committee. I kept wondering about the verdict of this six-person half-jury, and as far as I could figure it, two of them, Professor Heller and the lone woman on the committee, seemed to lean in my favor. Three seemed against my admission, and one seemed neutral, the head of the committee, who was politically savvy enough not to want to take a side. That meant, in my mind, I wouldn't make it in. Some of the questions were meant to reveal how I would feel about being around people with more money than I had. I explained to them that currently almost everyone that I knew had more money than I did, but that with a good education, I might well be able to catch up. My point was that Fieldston students weren't the only people in a better financial shape than I was. The questions about how I would feel in the middle of all these kids with money were questions they struggled with. They stood between me and the Fieldston community, Fieldston folks, but they were closer to my financial status than to that of the members of the Fieldston community. They may have been good at whatever they did, teach or administrate or whatever, but they were more like tutors with offices. One asked, "How would you feel if you saw one of your classmates go in a limousine while you were walking up the hill from the subway. Same way as you, I said. Y'all can't afford limousines. How do you feel? I could hear fear in their voices, and it was really there. They sounded intimidated, not by me, but by their surroundings. And all of their degrees can't get them on their knees, and their mastery in classes never gets them off their asses. They're always tiptoeing and elbowing, as loud as ghost whispers and as quick as grass be growing. Their spoiled students must be pampered, moving around like snails in amber. Their disciplinary instincts are all the way dead, smiling at this, patting that one on the head, on fire with midnight sunburns that take root under the collars. But little Lord have mercy, here is worth $1 million. At 10:15, they decided to break for a few minutes. I confided to the head of the committee that my mother had possibly been hospitalized and that I wanted to make a call. He directed me to a secretary in an inner office. I called Metropolitan Hospital and asked to speak to Mr. William Scott. After a short wait, BB came on the line. He sounded winded. "It's okay, sport," he said quietly. "It looks like we're going to have to bachelor pad it for a few weeks. Your mother is in a diabetic coma. She's going to have to take insulin like Sammy. We have some things to discuss, so you need to come down here." That was all I needed to know. There was somewhere else I needed to be. Now. The members of the committee were hovering over their chairs when I got back to the main room. "Excuse me, lady and gentlemen. I have something to say. I have to go. My mother landed at Metropolitan Hospital this morning. She's in a diabetic coma, and I have to be there with her. I know you folks were having this meeting especially to talk to me, and I appreciate that and want to thank you. But I'm leaving. If you all vote to allow me in here, I'll appreciate that. If you vote not to let me come, I'll understand it. But whatever you do, you're going to have to do it with the information you've got so far. I hope that's enough." I turned to Professor Heller. "Thank you, sir. You did a great deal for me, and you stuck with me. I thank you, but I'm about to go see my mother, okay?" I didn't feel like smiling, but the man deserved one. I nodded and acknowledged the other individuals around the room respectfully. Their somewhat stunned faces wore expressions that didn't know what to be. Caught between words, slapped without malice into another person's reality, far from the insulated isolation of their Riverdale routines. I shook hands with Professor Heller in case it was the last time I would see him. Then I walked out the door of the well-appointed chamber, away from the silver and the china and the cookies and committee, down the stairs to the door that led to the curving driveway, from there to the Broadway local train. I dropped a token in the slot. I had to get downtown. 13. I suppose I arrived at the hospital before either the doctor or Uncle Bebe expected, because all of a sudden I had walked up to where they were talking outside my mother's room and stepped between them to look. There was a nurse standing at the head of my mother's bed, adjusting tubes the size of cigars inserted in her throat. There was a surgical cap covering her hair. She was on a gurney with her eyes closed, and the small room where she was being treated was filled with the sound of her assisted breathing. The nurse was working in half-light dimness, walking quickly around the gurney, covering my mother carefully with a sheet, and examining every angle and aspect of the connections to a machine the size of a short refrigerator that expanded her chest and cleared her mouth of saliva. She was the color of cigarette ash. She was lucky she was in a coma and couldn't see herself, because seeing herself like this might have scared her to death. My uncle seemed to feel as though I was in danger of the same fate. He was staring blankly into a space unseen by others, focusing on instructions or recovery processes or excuses the doctor was giving for missing my mother's decline into her current condition. She had been in his office just a week before. When I stepped past them, I broke into my uncle's attempt to believe whatever this son of a bitch was lying about. Bibi reached out to bar my advance into the room. I understand that he didn't want me to see her. He didn't understand that I already had. I turned away from the two of them and walked a few steps back down the hallway. I could still hear the machine. A tense 2 or 3 minutes later, the doctor scurried past me and Bibi and was quickly at my elbow. He was an inch or so taller than me and 30 pounds heavier, but he looked exhausted and appreciably smaller than usual today. A ninny. He spat at the doctor's shrinking form as the nervous little man departed. I told myself I would never forget the doctor standing in the light of that 40-watt bulb at the bottom of our stairs, sniffing the air like an allergic albatross and hissing, acidosis. But we should have known. And I guess the fact that I knew that was the reason I didn't chase the little man down the army green hallway and kick his ass like a stuffed toy. I felt too much like kicking my own. I knew the little bird-beaked doctor should have averted this tragedy, but I should have too. And I saw beneath the shallows of my uncle's expression that he felt the same way I did, as though that lady in the hospital bed there had two men at her elbows whose responsibility was to look out for her, and we blew it. We blew an easy one. Shopping for the family groceries, making that Saturday run, had been one of my jobs since before we moved to New York. Not just for my mother, but for my grandmother before that. It was one of the ways I legitimately earned the 2 pennies or a nickel Aunt Sissy gave me when her budget expanded to include a cut of meat or some other extravagance from the A&P or another uptown market. Uptown was 5 or 6 blocks up Cumberland Street, easier and quicker once I got my red truck bike with a wire basket in front. In the Bronx, I just looked at restocking the refrigerator and cabinet as my job. My Saturdays automatically included an hour or so of carrying a list and rolling a shopping cart. I knew sometimes as clearly as my mother what we had and what we needed. I not only knew what our regular brands were, but the weekly quantities. In a special week, when something was going on, the six-pack of soda might clone itself on the list. In the recent weeks, though, I had regularly brought back 2 six-packs of soda on Saturday and another 1 or 2 six-packs during the week. I wasn't drinking any more soda than usual, but my mother was. I knew now that she had been fighting off dehydration and sugar imbalance with direct deposits of syrup and water. She had been tired, listless, and dehydrated and couldn't figure it out. Uncle Bibi had lived with Aunt Sammy, who'd had diabetes for 10 years by the time I stayed with them briefly after my grandmother's death. I guess it was different being around someone who was controlling the debilitating aspects of diabetes with tablets or injections of insulin. Bibi hadn't seen the onset of the illness, what their Tennessee neighbors called sugar diabetes. Bibi and I left the hospital and went for hot dogs at Nathan's, a late brunch, Bibi called it. I liked Nathan's most of the time, but this hot dog was like a rubber cigar. Not happening. My uncle went into normal mode, treating the outing like one of our haircut trips or once a month movie trips. Those were his contributions to normal, since he was supposed to be a father figure or male role model or some such, to teach me how to cope with things like my mother going into a coma. "How did your interview go?" he asked halfway through the meal. It was the first time I'd even thought about what had happened earlier that day. "Okay, I guess," I said. It seemed like they were asking me stuff they already knew, either from Professor Heller or from the long questionnaire you filled out. "Just wanted to see if you remembered what lies you told," he said, trying to crack a smile. I wouldn't have been the only one in that room who told lies, or the first one, or even the main one. Sitting in that room with the committee, I'd felt like I was at one of those theaters where the actors hold the face of the part they're playing in front of themselves on a stick. It's a play that's not even like a play. You're not even asked to suspend your disbelief like in an ordinary movie or play. They're holding the masks in front of them. That's what the committee hearing had felt like. I realized. I'm sure somebody reviewed all prospective students, but I was willing to bet they didn't have meetings like mine for the students paying full tuition, meetings where you sat there like a bug under a microscope, pushed and poked, taken like a joke. When Bibi and I got home, I heard him talking to his sisters and other relatives, bringing everyone up to date. I stayed in my room and he stayed in his as normal. I could tell he wanted to keep things as close to normal as possible, not making any radical declarations. Then, around 7 p.m., the phone rang. It was Professor Heller. The first question he asked was about my mother, and the second was about how I was doing. "Very well, thank you," I said, "but a hell of a day. I wanted you to know that you're to be granted a full scholarship." Evidently, my silence said a great deal to him. "I really believe that your handling of that call and the way you spoke to everyone before you left was crucial. You handled that very well, with decisiveness and maturity, with the proper attitude concerning priorities." 14. My mother quickly adjusted to being a full-fledged diabetic and went back to work. She had been moved to a desk job in the housing authority and spent her days at the Amsterdam houses on 61st Street. She claimed it was not a bad change. Our refrigerator held a tray of insulin. She had learned how to measure out her doses and inject herself with a needle. She made me watch the process one day, from how to jab yourself in a fingertip with a short silver needle and put a drop of blood on this paper that turned colors to tell you how much medication to take, to shooting herself in the hip and swabbing the injection point with alcohol. Then she came over to me with an orange and a fresh needle. "You need to know how to do this," she said half seriously. She knew that when it came to being brave, the world did not turn to me. I declined the opportunity to squirt some water into an orange right then. I told her I appreciated the vote of confidence, but that I was concentrating on her not needing me to do any injecting. She laughed and told me that even her brother would do it, and he was definitely an old scaredy cat. I told her that my fear took precedence because it was young and had to be nurtured. We laughed some more. My mother knew good and damn well there was no chance of my using the works. I had a thorough needle phobia. By the time I started at Fieldston that fall in September 1964, my mother and I had also moved to the Robert Fulton houses, in other words, the projects, down in Chelsea, living on our own in a two-bedroom place on West 17th Street between 9th and 10th Avenues. The project buildings covered 5 square blocks and were the center of a regeneration of that section of 9th Avenue with a small town's worth of barbershops, bodegas, pizza shops, record stores, and clothing stores. I quickly learned I was a minority within a minority. The neighborhood seemed to be 85% Puerto Rican, 15% white, and me. I did what I could to blend into Little San Juan without trading in my connection to Black America or the Temptations. The good news was that the rent for our new apartment was $73 per month. The bad news was that what would have been a 20-minute ride from our old place to Fieldston would now take at least an hour each way and involve switching trains. I had to take the train 230 blocks uptown to reach school. One look around the campus was enough to remind me how expensive the school was. The classroom buildings seemed to be held together with interlocking stones like medieval castle walls. The green lawns looked as though they were trimmed with scissors. There was a new gym with a glass backboards and room for 2 full-court games side by side. There was also a well-kept quarter-mile oval track and a manicured football field separated by a fence from a soccer pitch. The stage in the auditorium could handle full-scale productions for 500 viewers. There was a split-level art building for painting beneath skylights that always let in a lot of natural light. Music classes were taught in a cozy tower room you reached by climbing a spiral stone staircase above the auditorium and the student recreation room with its vending machines and ping pong tables. There were 3 pianos in the building, an upright for the theater stage that was available only when there was no class being held, another one in the music room up in the tower, and in a separate room next to the auditorium, a beautiful Steinway. It was an absolutely marvelous instrument, and not only was it the best piano around, it was the one that was almost always free and thoroughly accessible. Unfortunately, it was also the one the music teacher, Mr. Worthman, had established a rule against playing. Since I was the main one playing the kind of music Mr. Worthman objected to, I felt he might as well have called it the no-gill rule. Mr. Worthman headed the music department and the glee club. He reminded me of one of the villains from the Spider-Man comics I read. He had the same hooked beak, the same pale complexion, and most of all, the same horseshoe of white hair around a light bulb-shaped bald spot. We were opposites in appearance and in musical taste. But while I would never have tried to shut down his choral group, he showed more than mild disapproval of my music. He hated it. The first time I played the Temptations on the Steinway, when I had just arrived on campus, the wild dancing made enough noise to raise Professor Worthman from his crypt. He arrived in the music room to see it looking like a dance hall. I was just starting into a Stevie Wonder tune when I got busted. I felt like there was something personal going on between Mr. Worthman and me. Nobody could remember exactly when the Hands Off the Steinway rule had been posted, but I somehow connected it to something unreasonable and attributed the whole fabrication to Mr. Worthman. Maybe it had something to do with the songs I was writing. Maybe it was because I performed around school with other students but never joined the glee club. If all else failed, I could always play the "It's 'cause I'm from the ghetto" card. Though that didn't seem to apply to Mr. Worthman, he didn't seem to care that I was from the ghetto. you have options when you decide something is unfair. You can say to hell with it and play anytime and anywhere you see fit in open defiance of the rules. You can challenge it legally and carry it all the way to the Supreme Court or the high school equivalent. Or you can pick and choose your times. Hit and run. Try to avoid a showdown. I did that. I opted for a melodic form of guerrilla warfare, floating in and out with stealth and style. I mixed in a little black magic so that my fingers would be quicker than Mr. Worthman's eyes. I used clock management and stopped playing just before and just after lunch when my classmates had a few minutes to watch me get in trouble. I stopped doing all the flamboyant finger snappers from the radio. I stopped playing requests for the latest top 10 tunes by the Beatles and Rolling Stones, any of which would bring in a dozen unwanted singers. I stopped doing tunes that would inspire kids to unreasonable facsimiles of the dances from the new TV shows like Shindig and Hullabaloo. I didn't love confrontation, and I had been frequently warned that Mr. Worthman really enjoyed confrontation, that at times he was known to say it was one of his most effective teaching tools. There were times I would have challenged the professor if I'd gotten caught, times when I was working on my own songs. I had adopted a New York attitude since starting at Fieldston, and I had certain spaces that I didn't want rolled over anymore. But my scholarship also depended on being able not to react to personal injury, to getting pushed around, to personal restriction and harassment. Not that the scholarship was a big deal to me, but it was a big deal to someone who was a big deal to me, my mother. Still, I was in a good writing groove, and Mr. Worthman was in my way. He might snatch all the younger students sneaking in to play Stand By Me, but I planned to be the gorilla he missed. I was successful for a while. Months, in fact. Then, in April, I was sitting alone at the keyboard during a free period of mine that I often spent playing ping pong. I'd had a sudden creative inspiration. I often heard tunes in my head. But this one arrived with words attached like bright bulbs on a Christmas tree. No sooner had I sat down to play than Mr. Worthman arrived with a short, pudgy gentleman in overalls with a handlebar mustache and a toolbox. The mustached man ignored me and slid a metal box beneath the Steinway, walked gingerly to the side, and pushed up the flat top. He propped it open at a 45-degree angle, exposing the mechanics of the piano's wires and pads. There are few things more beautiful than the strings of a Steinway. I watched every little move the piano tuner made under the hood. Mr. Worthman, meanwhile, was making sweeping motions with both hands, directing me toward the door, too distracted for a protracted lecture. "Heron, you know the rule," he barked. He was also talking to the other man about what needed to be done. Total A440 with a pad that needs to be changed on the F sharp in the third octave. It sounds like it's got damp or something. Then again to me, "I'll deal with you later." He was sweeping again like, "Out, out, damn Scott." I wanted to stay and watch the piano tuner, but I left and forgot the song I had been just about to capture. If I was able to play a song once, I would have it. This one had gotten away. Things were still cool for a while. I didn't see Mr. Worthman at all for a few weeks, and his not seeing me kept anything from triggering his memory. I should have left well enough alone. I should have left the piano alone. But not having been able to remember the song pushed me toward a point where I thought I wouldn't mind a confrontation. So I did what I wanted to do. I had a plan. The choral group had their big spring recital coming up on the quadrangle, and there would be extra rehearsals after school. Meetings during class time would be scuttled. The piano would be sitting there all day, every day, without anybody coming in to play it. That was almost obscene. My strategy seemed to work. For the next 3 weeks, I stopped by the Steinway every day for a few chords or a verse or two of my latest song. I was starting to get comfortable. One afternoon at the end of April, Mr. Werthmann landed in the Steinway room as if he'd leaped from a tower in a parachute. I was too astonished even to show surprise. When he caught his breath and his face started to regain its natural pallor, he said, "You're in a lot of trouble this time, young man. I hope you know that. I've got a good mind to have them take you up before the disciplinary committee. We'll have your parents in." When the letter arrived at home a few days later from the disciplinary committee at Fieldston, I had forgotten Mr. Werthmann's threat. I expected it to raise my mother's blood pressure and her voice, but that wasn't her way. When she called me into the kitchen, I didn't know what to expect, but her flat tone of voice raised the hairs along the length of my arms. "You want to tell me what this letter's all about?" she asked, holding it in front of her face like a fan. "What does it say?" I said, taking a seat at the kitchen table opposite her. "It says that I need to appear with you in front of the discipline committee next Monday for a 9 a.m. meeting." I took a breath. "I played a piano," I said quietly. "That's what this is about? You played a piano, and I'm supposed to come up to your school about it?" "Yeah. This music teacher said they might call you up there, but I swear I thought he was joking." She paused for a beat. "So you played a piano, and then what?" "Then nothing. That's all I did was play the piano." "You usually tell the truth," she said, "but I don't hear it." She sat for another moment. "Did you hit someone like the music teacher?" "No, ma'am." I had heard from other students that Fieldston had a no suspension policy. They believed that suspension gave the students a vacation from classes. I had told my mother about that. "We'll see about this," my mother finally said, as though she were really exhausted. "I don't need to be going up there and getting a surprise. You may as well tell me the whole thing." The next Monday, we trudged up the hill after the long subway journey. I had told her about many times. She was surprised but pleased to see the cookies and tea service and coffee pot and the discipline folks engaged in pleasant conversation and sipping coffee from good china and munching on dainty cookies. I didn't have much of an appetite. The face-off was called to order, and my mother and I sat side by side facing a similar semicircle to the one I'd met a year prior when she was ill and I left early. "Mrs. Heron," the principal began, "we're facing something of a problem here, and we need your input. You see, Mr. Werthmann here caught Gil playing the piano." My mother's reaction was almost imperceptible. She relaxed her shoulders and recrossed her legs. Her expression was pleasant enough, a little smile. And she looked critically from face to face as though waiting for the punchline of a joke. the principal's voice droned to a close, and I saw Mr. Worthman stare with energy and focus at me. He had been waiting for this moment, and now he was speaking too loudly with certain emphasis, as though it was a prepared speech that he had rehearsed. He talked about how valuable the Steinway was, and how he had caught me playing it before, and how the rule had been put in place to prevent students from playing boogie-woogie. I didn't notice the transition when Mr. Worthman had finished and suddenly collapsed in his seat as the principal started speaking again. He said something about how it would be easy for the committee to mete out the punishment, but that at Fieldston they thought it was important for the parents to be involved, and that what they wanted was my mother's recommendation. The pause between the principal's question and my mother's response fell on each member of the committee like a guillotine. She took a long breath before turning in my direction. "Expel him," she said crisply and clearly. "I understand that you don't suspend students, and I understand why. I agree with you. I don't believe in suspending students either. So if you believe playing the piano is high on your list of offenses, expel him." She was dominating the room now. Her voice was clear and her diction was perfect. "I'm going to work now. If you expel him, he'll tell me when I get home." It was an amazing piece of business. There hadn't been a second when she seemed shaken or awkward or the least bit uncomfortable. She looked every bit the well-dressed businesswoman, perfectly at ease, and as she gathered her bag and scarf, she could easily have been heading out to a waiting limousine instead of to the subway, as was actually the case. Finally, she turned to the committee members as we were leaving. "When he told me what this was all about, I didn't believe him. I thought he had finally done something that he was too embarrassed to tell me about, that he had lost this wonderful opportunity, and we would both be humiliated to sit here when I heard the truth. He told me the truth. He said he had been playing a piano. I will only add this. When something goes wrong on 17th Street, I don't call you, because that's my responsibility, and this is your school. If he has done something that merits punishment, don't call me. Send him home. We'll understand. I need to have him show me the way back down that hill. You can tell him whatever you decide." I resisted the urge to look back at Mr. Worthman. We walked down the hill without saying much. That was another thing I appreciated about my mother. She wasn't afraid of silence. By the time we'd arrived at the base of the stairs that led up to the subway, she had come back to herself. "I want you to leave those people's things alone," she said. "You're up here to get an education. Get it and come on home. I'm sorry I didn't believe you. I learned something today, too." I think she and I got a lot closer that day. 15. I am extremely pleased to report that I only had one session with Fieldston Disciplinary Committee. That does not mean that I committed only one infraction. That would be ridiculous. I guess it's a little like being charged with a first offense, even if it's the 10th time you've done something. It's the first time you got caught. In that respect, I can never accuse the people of Fieldston, neither the students nor the faculty, of being racist. I can accuse the students of knowing each other for years and preferring to hang out with each other instead of some guy who just got there. I can't accuse the teachers of having taught my classmates for 10 years and me for 10 minutes. But I can't say they never took the time to tell me that I was doing as little work as I did. So there were students and faculty members and executives who did not like me. But to their credit, I honestly believe that they just didn't like me. What's wrong with that? There were a lot of black folks who felt the same way over the years. They were just less anxious to let me know it. Most of this wisdom was acquired over my 3 years there. As a 10th grade rookie, my first year there, I was working overtime at Jackson's or wherever the hell I could to make ends meet and stay afloat in Spanish class. I felt more comfortable as the years went on. It was just a school after all. I had probably set some sort of poverty precedent by receiving a scholarship to cover books as well as tuition. The books at public school were free, but at Fieldston, I found the cost beyond my legal reach and mentioned the possibility of a heist, which inspired Professor Heller to get me a voucher that I used for $64 worth of knowledge. My mother and I didn't have enough money for it to be one of my issues. I took every opportunity that showed up on 17th Street. I managed to catch a run at the A&P supermarket on 8th Avenue 3 nights a week, and since I had improved a great deal on piano and still kept up with the top tunes on the radio, I looked for jobs as keyboard player with some rhythm and blues or rock and roll bands in the city. I managed to hook up with a few groups for weekend jobs at schools and hotel bars and at birthday parties. There was a whole culture then a few levels down from the bands we were imitating. The bread was short, $20 or $25 a night, but it beat the hell out of nothing. Every summer from the time I was 16, I took a job as a seasonal worker for the Housing Authority. I spent one summer at the St. Nicholas Houses on 135th Street in Harlem, one at the Dyckman Houses on the Upper West Side, and one at the Housing Authority's central office at 250 Broadway. That turned out to be a very good summer. Aside from the 9-to-5 I was doing Monday through Friday, I signed up as a referee for 4 or 5 games of basketball every weekend. The New York City Housing Authority had a summer basketball league and furnished uniforms, scorebooks, time clocks, and balls for 2 teams in every set of projects. The authority also made up a schedule, made sure the court was available, and assigned a referee to officiate the game and turn in a report to the central office at 250 Broadway. That's where I came in. Refs were paid $10 a game so I could make an extra $40 or $50 per weekend. My shelf work at A&P started at 7 p.m. and ended between midnight and 2 a.m. I would send inventory upstairs from the basement or stand upstairs with a hand truck snatching crates of canned goods, bottles, and cans. Dairy products and meats needed to be stacked weekend deep before the Saturday deluge. All the weekend sales, specials, and new product displays had to be stacked and stamped. All the summer work ended up paying for college tuition. I had decided to attend Lincoln University after my 1967 graduation from Fieldston. I wanted to go to Lincoln because it seemed to be a place where black writers had come to national prominence, perhaps because of its location. If not exactly the middle of nowhere, at least on one side or the other. It was outside of Oxford, Pennsylvania, about 45 miles from Philadelphia, 55 miles from Baltimore, and 30 miles from Wilmington, Delaware. Perhaps that isolation and absence of urban distractions had allowed the creativity and intellect of Langston Hughes, Melvin Tolson, Ron Welburn, and others to flourish. Whatever the reason, I thought the place was extraordinary. its students had made noteworthy accomplishments and in a number of areas. Kwame Nkrumah got his degree there in the 1930s and went on to become the leader of independent Ghana. Cab Calloway had gone there, and my candidate for Man of the Century, NAACP lawyer and first black on the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall, went to Lincoln, too. The school was founded as the Ashman Theological Institute in 1854 at the insistence of the Quakers, who formed a powerful political force in Pennsylvania. In an era when it was still illegal to teach blacks to read and write unless they were ministers, Ashman was not only a tool of political appeasement for the Quakers, it was a double blessing for blacks who now had both an institution of higher education, a first, and a safe house across the Maryland line that could be used as a rest stop and hiding place on the Underground Railroad. In 1869, 4 years after the War Between the States, and 4 years after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln at Ford's Theater, the small school for the aspiring black theologians in southeastern Pennsylvania was renamed Lincoln University. Abraham Lincoln was not a factor in my decision to go there, though I obviously knew the place had not been named for a luxury automobile. Black Americans have always held to the idea that Honest Abe was a friend of the downtrodden and mistreated slaves in spite of his Kentucky birthplace and pragmatism on the slavery issue, as in, if I could save the Union and allow the institution of slavery to continue. The fact was, he couldn't have allowed slavery and still hung on to abolitionist support, so he authored a document that was politically expedient, the Emancipation Proclamation that is credited with Jubilee as the news slowly spread through the South, causing the celebrations blacks refer to as Juneteenth. The Lincoln of Langston Hughes and Thurgood Marshall was not the place it had been when I got off the bus in September of 1967. School leadership had jettisoned a 112-year tradition as a male institution the year before. There were a large number of co-eds unloading their trunks and bags from family station wagons. The general attitude of Lincoln's executives was notably animated. Their conversations centered around how necessary it was for black schools to be open to change and how good it was that in spite of diminishing funds and contributions to black schools because of the disturbances on college campuses across the nation, Lincoln was growing. That in spite of the destruction of a century of traditions, Lincoln would be a stronger institution in the end. Certain old schoolers seemed unsettled by all the change. Juniors and seniors, as well as veterans returning from service in the armed services, found the rapid expansion and co-educational system distasteful because of new restrictions and rules of conduct at odds with their lives before the admission of women. A lot of upperclassmen grumbled that they were glad they'd be leaving, and the vets that were sorry they had returned. I felt fortunate to have arrived when, through these older students, there was still a shadow of the tradition that had been so much of an influence on the Lincoln men who helped shape Black America, but the place felt like a campus in flux. The years before a conflict never receive the micro scrutiny, but the fuses are lit then for the future upheaval and mutiny. Because small events in corners no one cares to see as critical become defining moments later underlined as pivotal. Pennsylvania's Quakers knew a lot about persecution and, to their credit, tried to find acceptable solutions, speaking about the Northerners who wallowed in hypocrisy, continuing to discriminate from behind walls of bureaucracy. so few cared in 1854 when some religious dignitaries founded a school for colored folks called Ashman Seminary. Each state politician would congratulate himself for preserving the reputation of the entire Commonwealth. They successfully stopped the Quakers from raising so much hell and kept them from putting another crack in the Liberty Bell. Off the beaten path was nearby when compared to this school's isolation, overlooking how perfect a place it would be for an underground railroad station. To get back to Philadelphia back then took the best part of a day. There was a small village called Oxford, but that was more than 3 miles away. There's no one to disturb, no one to object, just farms and farmers out there. 15 miles from the mushroom capital, a marketing town, Kennett Square. For 100 years, the school progressed in relative obscurity. Its distance from any place known as a place provided some both-way security. Another Lincoln University out in Missouri helped to keep folks confused. As to the ground shaken by American giants like Thurgood Marshall and Langston Hughes, but the 1960s brought black power and then student organizations from colleges became involved leading the sit-in demonstrations. Suddenly, schools like Lincoln with black student populations suffer corporate backlash and diminishing donations. They bring in a white president despite laughter from black schools, and Marvin Wackman comes in with a thick stack of new rules. He says changes are the cure for the financial condition and overnight erases Lincoln's 100-year tradition, becoming state-related and instituting co-education. Old school alumni and returning vets resent the alterations. They had made their own rules out there in the wilderness, and isolation of the location had built a strong togetherness. Lincoln's reputation was already going down in flames. When I got there in 67, the place was filling up with dames. I didn't resent the women, but there weren't enough to go around. I didn't resent the state-related kids from nearby towns, but something else was happening, and students weren't supposed to know. Lincoln's state relationship included COINTELPRO. As now that you've got background and a certain point of view, I'm awarding you a scholarship to go with me to Lincoln U.
Context of White Supremacy, that is the first audio segment. The Last Holiday, Gil Scott Heron. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If you want to chime in, but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you put in that address, you'll see the link on the left of the page. It says a VOPE line, free VOPE line. When you click that, it will open a small window on your screen.
the top line. It is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The code, you'll see that on the next line. It's 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can click random keys. You can put in your real name. If you're comfortable with that, you can use a nickname, whatever. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. We'll connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the green button on your screen to call in on the VOAP application. You'll see the dial pad, on the VOAP application on your screen. Same procedure as if you dial in on your phone. Press *6 on the dial pad. When you do so, you'll hear the audio prompt. Press the number 1. We'll get you on the line. With that, if folks have commentary they would like to share, the folks who dialed in, who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to chime in. Let's see.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I'll start out. I got 4 points here. Number one, I believe the doctor was a racist suspect. The way Gill described him as bird-beaked-nosed and failing to properly treat his mother, Miss Bobby Scott, for diabetes. I think it was an act of racism because she had been in his office just a week earlier. I did a little calculation. She'd been about 47 at the time. And another telltale point is when he came into the apartment building, he said acidosis, which it was a reference to ketoacidosis, severe sugar imbalance. A person who had diabetes or was borderline diabetic should have been on some type of pills or insulin. And I think that the doctor knew about her condition, and it qualifies in that category with medical apartheid, you know, black people not being treated like white people in the medical field by failing to inform them of their condition. And he felt bad because he noticed that she was drinking about a case or so a week. She was still suffering from dehydration, fatigue, and then taking sugar and syrup directly to offset the imbalance. So he felt bad about himself. And as far as the school goes, he had to go before a panel of powerful whites. And they can make you or break you. And a lot of time in a system of white supremacy, victims find themselves in that same predicament where powerful whites will be sitting around determining your fate. Shout out to his mom for a black self-respect. She believed her son when she went to the school. Back to the committee. He was sitting around the committee, and he said it was like being in a theater where, on page 95, where the actors would hold a picture in front of their face, the part that they was playing on a stick. And he felt like a bug under a microscope being pushed and poked, taken like a joke. And last, Mr. Worthman, the music teacher, may have been practicing racism, restricting the playing on the Steinway piano. But first, there were three pianos, an upright on the theater stage, another one in the music room, and the Steinway was in a separate room next to the auditorium. It struck me that Gil may have been rebellious by insisting to play the expensive piano. But then on the other hand, the acoustics of a fine instrument like that would probably be too much of a temptation. He did say on page 102 that there was few things more beautiful than the strings of a Steinway. And in his mind, Mr. Werfman didn't seem to care that he was from the ghetto. And that's another thing. We're constantly being deceived by these people. They don't have your best interest at mind. And a healthy dose of skepticism is always a good prescription. I'll mute my line. Thanks for taking the call, girl.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery. For I think he has his book now, so he can give more detailed participation. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Good points by Mr. Demery for. Hopefully I can add on some more. He sounded very mature in that and codified in that interview. And I kind of like just thought about myself if I was faced to be in that type of situation on how poorly I probably would have been able to articulate at that particular point in time and age. Diabetes is a main point of illness for black people. If I was listening to about the condition his mother was in. Number three, Mr. Gil Scott-Heron seemed to be a Motown sound fan, which wasn't unusual, especially during that point in time. It was Motown was getting at his it was kind of like still early, but they were really getting up there to be very, very, very popular. Like a lot of musical artists, they started in school, middle school, high school, as far as their base of learning music. Some, you know, some, especially singers, it was in the quote unquote the church, but with a lot of black musical artists, it started in school, just like his start. And some of the same, what I would call, what someone would call antics. There's always a rebellion because of the music that is taught to you in on those levels, especially a black male or a black person, period. It's kind of like, you know, very, very white orientated. And our spiel of music is much more jazzier, and I can understand his ambition to not only want to play that piano, but also from a standpoint on what he was playing on the piano. I have down here, Shindig and Hullabaloo. It just brought a memory as a child. It was very, very popular variety shows on TV in the 60s, those two programs. Benny King, he mentioned about Benny King, Stand By Me, very, very popular song during that period of time. I already mentioned about how he was molding. I think he was molding his type of music, which is, you know, which can be understood as being rebellious, you know, by some. I just say he was speaking the truth for the most part in his music. Honesty, counter-racist honesty in his music. I think he was molding that by insisting upon playing, first of all, playing on something he reportedly didn't have any business playing on, and then playing what he wanted to play. And it just came to my mind that one thing about those white people, they didn't want to hear that nigga music anyway. That's primarily, they may not have said it, but that's primarily has always been my thought to that side of that talk, that type of resistance. But yet still, when you look at who buys music, it's primarily white people. Last but not least, I just marveling at how witty his mother was in situations with white people. And that was unprecedented on what she said. It was like razor sharp logic, hey, you people are wasting my time. You're wasting my time, with this foolishness. And she just like, quickly would go to the bottom line. Okay, if he's doing something wrong, then kick him out. But don't be wasting my time on something like that. And like was mentioned, I applaud her for trusting her child. And that's all I have right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. There was a clicking noise. I heard it in the program yesterday, and then I didn't hear it while the audio was playing, but I heard it just when we began our dialogue here, and I listened in. I don't hear it now, so it looks like it might have been corrected. People can feel free to let me know if you're listening on TuneIn or Black Talk Radio Network if there's a problem or distortion in the audio. But as I said, I don't hear it right now. I'll continue to check. Didn't hear it during the audio segment, so it shouldn't have been an issue there. But if you have any problems listening in, if there's disruption, distortion, drop me an email, let me know. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Seeing other hands. I know people wrote in as well. Let me make sure I get this person's commentary who did write in. She says, non-white female listener. She says, I believe it was Emmy who discussed her like of autobiographies, and Gus T as well. I also like autobiographies. You get intimate details about a person's life, and you get a clearer understanding of who that person is. I also find that the people who write them are quite brave. They allow themselves to be vulnerable and open to criticism, which may follow after someone reads their book. It also gives the opportunity to stop speculations about who and what they are in their own words. What I found of interest is the connection Mr. Scott Heron had with his mother's side of the family, especially his interactions with his grandmother, Lily Scott. She gave him an understanding of how to speak his mind, which I'm sure helped him when he decided that poetry and songwriting would be the purpose and in his life. He had strong male images in his life in the form of his uncles. His mother's side instilled in him love. I was reminded of Dr. Welsing when the father and mother were no longer together. The whole playing with sex. I'm not sure how to process his father leaving to pursue a soccer career. It is only non-white people, specifically black people, who have to make that seemingly selfish decision because white supremacy forces this. Is it a cultural thing with non-white people to leave their children in the care of grandparents, aunts, etc., or is this a byproduct of white supremacy? After the passing of his grandmother and his subsequent return to his mother and having to relearn her love for him was demonstrated by speaking to him as someone who had a say in his own life. I think this may have a lot to do with how he showed sensitivity to her by not pressing her for things he knew she would be unable to afford. This showed some wisdom, no doubt, imparted to him by his grandmother, Lily Scott. His admiration for Mr. Stevie Wonder was obvious, and the feeling was
was mutual. Mr. Wonder showing up at Mr. Scott Heron's concerts unannounced. The work that both put in, along with Mrs. King and family, for the National Martin Luther King Jr. holiday was outstanding. Mr. Scott Heron, speaking of the Bronx, brought back fond memories of my childhood. So far, good read. One of our listeners' commentary as well. I'll share in some of my thoughts. Keep an eye out to see if other people have commentary they would like to share as well. Some of the things that stood out in the first part of the reading from this week, they had a shout out to A&P grocery store. I don't know if people are familiar. They makes a cameo appearance in Driving Miss Daisy, one of my favorite flicks. I was just talking about that with one of our listeners. Let's see. What he's talking about when he and his mom, when they moved and got their own place, they moved out of Uncle Bebe's spot in New York. And he says, the good news, you know, it was affordable. I think it was like $75 a month back at this time in the 60s. The bad news was that they would have been a 20-minute ride from their old place to Fieldston, would now take at least an hour each way and would involve switching trains. I had to take the train 230 blocks uptown to reach school. I've just seen consistently where black people have to make those type of just extraordinary treks to get to resources where because of the system of white supremacy, racist, they can just, you know, plop us down here and say, well, now you're going to have to travel 20 miles to get clean water. Now you're going to have to travel 20 miles to get to your job. Now you're going to have to travel 20 miles to get to school. Like, they do these sort of things on a constant basis, just making it very, very difficult for us to get to quality resources. Next up, when he's talking about this whole piano thing at the school, he says not only was it the best piano around, this is the Steinway, it was the one that was almost always free and thoroughly accessible. Unfortunately, it was also the one the music teacher, Mr. Worthman, had established a rule about playing. Since I was the main one playing the kind of music Mr. Worthman objected to, I felt he may as well have called it the no-gill rule. I think we talked about this a lot in the context of workplace racism, where it seems whites make rules specifically for one individual nigger that has gotten on their nerves or has maybe figured out some way where he's doing a little better than they would like in the system. So they will go around and change the code and do something just to get this one specific black person. I think even Mumia Abu-Jamal, they were talking about that. Some of the whites were upset that he was still getting speaking engagements, even though he's in greater confinement to do commencements and that sort of a thing. So they were trying to, you know, stop him from being able to speak and what have you. You know, convicted nigger, we don't want to hear from you. Some of the other things I noted, let's see. I loved when he's describing Mr. Worthman. I don't know if that's this guy's real name or not, but even that in the name, as though this race soldier educator is in the name worthy. He is a worthy man, though he's a race soldier. But where he describes him, he says Mr. Worthman had the same hooked beak, the same pale complexion, and most of all, the same horseshoe of white hair around a light bulb shaped bald spot. When he's comparing him to the villains in the Spider-Man comic books, and I feel that is so rare, where it is uncommon, where we are saying, hey, the pattern here, the villains, the bad guys, the psychopaths, the person that we want to see destroyed, is the one with the pale complexion. Like, that would be grand to just have that be the case consistently, where we're pointing that out and recognizing, yes, the sinister ones are the pale ones. Continuing, he says, the wild dancing made enough noise to raise Professor Worthman from his crypt. Loved the metaphor, describing him as not human. He arrived, or certainly not even being alive, he arrived in the music room to see it looking like a dance hall. I was just starting into Stevie Wonder tune when he got busted. I just find it so wild because, well, I found that paragraph important because in any generation, right, black music is generally regarded as wild, hooligan, dangerous, primitive, criminal. Like, in this era,
it's Stevie Wonder, which is, I mean, that is incredible. If you think about it now, at least in my perception, I think if you walked in and you were playing, you know, Stevie Wonder, anything that Stevie Wonder did, I think, you know, I don't think too many white people would be upset now. But whatever the contemporary black music is from any era, it seems to be perceived that way. If you go back to the 1960s, 1970s, it would have been James Brown would have been thought of in that way, you know, playing Black and I'm Proud and that sort of thing would have been thought of in that manner. If you go back out where in this era, it would be what they call hip hop music. If you go back even further, it would be jazz. It would be Miles Davis and what have you. And we don't want all that, you know, rhythm and blues and gyrating and, you know, illicit Negro music. In any era, black people are criminalized and the music and art of black people is criminalized and stolen all the way around. Happened to Gil Scott Heron as an artist as well. Where he talks about what I thought of as a code, and he describes this warfare with Mr. Worthman, or not even warfare. He makes all these rules to stop Gil from being able to access the Steinway, which is supposed to be a part of the benefit, right? If you can think about this with white children, it's not like he's making a bomb. It's not like he's bringing firearms or knives to school. Playing a piano where white children, their creativity, oh, yes, come in, play the piano, play, use all of the instruments, use all of the tools, learn, explore, grow. That's how you're going to develop. Like, that's the attitude that young white kids get. Black children, oh my God, you touch that piano again, we'll have you in jail. I mean, it's totally criminalized for just playing a piano. I mean, and this is the type of thing that I think about when some people say that because of racism, white supremacy, artists like Gil Scott Heron become more amazing because they had to go through so much to become artists. And it, you know, it may be the struggle, so they say, maybe that helped strengthen their talents and make them, you know, better artists. And they'll say that type of thing for Serena Williams as well. Maybe all the racism and everything that she had to endure made her a better tennis player. I don't take that position at all. The position I take is the exact opposite. If Gil Scott Heron, Serena Williams, Dr. Welsing, if they were encouraged, if Dr. Welsing went to a college where the president didn't have a dog named Nigger, if Gil Scott Heron had a music teacher who encouraged him, a music teacher, yes, play the piano. Yes, play the songs that you like. Here are some other songs. I got you a music book of some of the Temptations hits so you can play those. Had really encouraged him so he could do all that. Wow, maybe he would have been an even better musician. Maybe he would have been even more talented. The system, the Mr. Worthmans, the Mr. and Mrs. Worthmans of the world, they do so much damage and just crushing a lot of what the potential of a lot of black children from this age and younger. But I really dug Gil's code when he says, I'm not trying to go for confrontation with Mr. Worthman. I'm just going to try to avoid this. I'm just going to try and sneak in and play a little bit when I can. When he's not there, when I won't get in trouble for it. And I'll make sure that I do it at times where I know it'll be unlikely for me to be caught. And I'll make sure that I stop. I won't play the tunes to attract a big crowd. I mean, that is so super codified in my opinion. He says it was working well for months, in fact, which, you know, further tells me good codification. And I thought it was great because he said explicitly, Gil is not about confrontation. That's why he's doing this. I'm doing my guerrilla piano playing. Mr. Worthman really enjoyed confrontation, according to what he said. And he went further. He says that confrontation was one of his most effective teaching tools. That is appalling, in my opinion. And I suspect that is the attitude that white race soldiers bring into the classroom under the guise of being an instructor, that I'm here for confrontation with these black children. That's what I'm here for. That's the moment when I get to teach them, this is your place, nigra. Get you suspended. Get you out of school for a few. What? Did you touch that piano? Did you drop that pencil? That's going to be another 5-day suspension. Confrontation in the classroom. Yes. Continuing, let's see. I thought the whole scene with his mom when she's going to have to go talk to the discipline committee and she gets the note and she's like, you know, what happened? What did you do? Are you serious? This is about a piano. You're leaving something out. I don't even believe you. Did you hit someone? I'm reading Dr. Curry's book, The Man Knot. He'll be on the program Tuesday. And he talks about how this is standard. Any black male in particular, black child, you can be a black boy, black older person, doesn't matter. Black males, period, you're always thought of as a violent threat that needs to be castrated and killed. Maybe not in that order. But I thought for even here, just playing the piano, now even your own mom is fielding questions of, did you hit somebody? Did you go upside someone's head? Like, I was just playing a piano. I'm inspired by the Temptations. I just want to play the piano. And this is, you know, the point where it escalates to. And this happens all the time to black children, even right now, 2017. Continuing, when they get to the whole meeting, loved his mother's response. I agree with the caller's monumental illustration of black self-respect, the way that she conducted herself in the whole meeting. And afterwards, telling him specifically, my bad for not believing you when you told me, Gil, that, you know, this was all about a piano, and to leave these white people's things alone. Because I feel like that is very rare where it gets that explicit, where it's, yes, we're talking about white people and their racist conduct and things that we're going to have to do in terms of adjusting our behavior. Just leave their stuff alone completely, because I don't have time to waste with these people, and I don't want them criminalizing you because you, you know, looked or breathed or touched their chair or their piano or some other piece of property that they have here. And now we got to haul this Negro child off for grand theft in the local New York school. Just, I thought that was great. I really appreciated the way that she handled the whole situation. And even his codification, where Gil says he wanted to turn around and kind of look back at Mr. Werthmann, like, take that. But he even resisted that urge because he knew he had to still come back and go to that school. I thought that was great all the way around. I think I had said before that, it seemed Langston Hughes had a big impact on him. He talked about reading. I think he said that the first column that he read in the Chicago Defender was the Langston Hughes column. I think we read some of that. Just Be Simple. I think we talked about some of that before. And then he says it again. He goes to Lincoln. We'll hear more about that in the next audio segment. But him going to Lincoln, he says, Langston Hughes's alma mater seems like he just had a huge impact. And a lot of the poetry that you've heard in the book, really strong influence from Langston Hughes. I'm very curious to hear what people think about the way that he opens chapter 15, where he takes time to say the whites at Fieldston are not racist, where he says explicitly, in that respect, I can never accuse the people of Fieldston, neither the students nor the faculty, of being racist. I can accuse the students of knowing each other for years and preferring to hang out with each other instead of some guy who just got there. I can accuse the teachers of having taught my classmates for 10 years and me for 10 minutes, but I can't say they never took the time to tell me what I was doing, that I was doing as little work as I did. This whole section where he talks about other black people who didn't like him over the years and, you know, what's the big deal? I thought that whole section was fascinating. I won't even give comments because I would be very eager to hear what listeners made of that portion of the reading. I really appreciated the segment where he talked about Abraham Lincoln and just being expedient, practicing racism, not having any altruistic concern for the fate of enslaved black people going into the Civil War. Appreciated that. And I even appreciating the detail that he added about a lot of times black people being confused and thinking, oh, yes, Abraham Lincoln was a white ally, a good white person. But the caller, last four digits, 6900. 6900, did you have commentary? Caller in Virginia, I think.
Greetings, Gus. This is Jay from New York.
New York.
Greetings to the callers and listeners. Just wanted to give a couple of pieces of feedback here. Great read thus far. Really excited about the book. Many of the points that I had have already been mentioned, so I'm just going to kind of echo a couple of things. I wanted to add on in reference to the situation with Mr. Werthmann, and kind of as everybody was talking about it, I thought about this is school property. This is a school property piano that's in the classroom of a music teacher. And it seems like this Mr. Werthmann is actually taking this piano as his own personal piano and dictating the rules, and the school is actually standing behind him on this. So that actually was pretty interesting, but as you said, kind of makes sense in terms of the terrorism that goes on in the classrooms for young black boys and young black girls. I definitely feel that in reference to the relationship that Gil kind of fostered with his mother coming back after the death of his grandmother, and the respect that they had for one another. I saw that play out in the situation when they went up to the school together. Even in the situation after she came home from the situation at the hospital. But definitely a great deal of respect between the two, which is definitely great in terms of fostering their belief in one another. And being from the New York area and just kind of hearing the flashbacks, the AMPs, and I'm from the Brooklyn area, but, you know, kind of just all the activity that was going on in Lower Manhattan, up in the Bronx area. So definitely good to kind of hear about that activity during a time frame that I wasn't familiar with, because I'm a little bit younger than that period. So so real good to provide some additional commentary. But that's all I have for now. Thanks.
Right on. The start of the 15th chapter, that's the portion for reader or for other folks listening in. That's where the portion where I said about Gil declaring nobody at Fieldston was racist, and then him giving his reasons. Right, it's right at the second paragraph, right at the beginning.
It actually lowers our suspiciousness against them, because on the other side of this equation, they can be very terroristic, very nasty, and very confrontational, all of the negatives. And, you know, when one of us individually run into them as a victim of racist white supremacy, that falls prey to that analysis in that light. Hopefully I made some sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Was logical to me, sir. Other folks with us who wanted to respond to that, what do we make of him declaring no one at Fieldston is racist?
Yes, I'd like to.
I'm sorry, okay. Mr. Demi Ford, go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to respond in the paragraph above that he got away with so much without, you know, being in front of the disciplinary committee that, you know, he made that statement, which just goes to show that, you know, black people are ignorant when it comes to racism. But I wanted to say one more thing. They mentioned Langston Hughes and Thurgood Marshall as going to Lincoln University. And they had a vote on it, and Thurgood Marshall voted to leave it like it was. And he gave some asinine reasons, but it just goes to show when Thurgood Marshall himself was around 20, 21, whatever, he was ignorant of racism, and Langston Hughes was responsible, partly responsible for helping him to enlighten him about the urgency of black people's situation during that time. I thought that was interesting.
I still, I want to get Jay in New York's response to the what do we make of no racists at Fieldston, but just since he mentioned it, Marvin Wackman, this is the white president at Lincoln, the nation's oldest college, established to educate blacks in 1961 after teaching for 13 years at Colgate University and spending 2 years as director of the Salzburg Seminar in Austria. Lincoln, founded in 1854 in Chester County, southwest of Philadelphia, had a distinguished educational record, but was in some financial and accreditation difficulties. Dr. Wackman, who was white, was initially reluctant to become president of a black college at the height of the civil rights movement, but was persuaded to do so by Thurgood Marshall, a Lincoln alumnus.
And as victims, and you know, as we continue to try and learn, I guess it would be just not understanding. As I read this, I honestly believe that they just didn't like me. And I think as a victim, you personalize it. And I think that's probably what Gil was doing, just personalizing it, saying it can't be everyone, but they just didn't like me. And for him being there for just that short period of time, and they just not like him, that's the battle that you go through when you're in these environments trying to get some type of acknowledgement. from individuals in higher positions and even at work, I guess, as you're trying to get acknowledgement from people, their dominance and not giving you that acknowledgement is where they kind of get their win while you're continually trying to get that. So to me, that was pretty powerful for him to say that they just didn't like him, kind of further put him in.
My thoughts about that, I agree with the commentary that was stated already. And exactly, I think, as Mr. Demery Ford said, some of the things that he's listening to me sound like these are acts of racism. Their preference, although he says that their preference is not racial, I insist that these preferences, directly, indirectly, yes, they are. And I think oftentimes when people say that, oh, well, I just have a preference, or we just know, they had been there. He said the teachers, they had been teaching some of these students for 10 years and he just got there. That for sure is the deliberate act of racism. That's what people were part of, what people were running around in the street for at that very time that all of this was happening. So I think if anything, it just reminds me of what Mr. Fuller says, why he has that on page one. If you do not understand racism, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. And that a lot of times we are looking right at acts of racism and not recognizing it for what it is. And I would say also, if anything, Mr. Werthmann for sure has to qualify as sounds like one racist. And even Mr. Werthmann doesn't get classified as a racist. I just, in my view, I think that is a part of the programming. That is the effect when you have Lincoln University named after a white man, where the difficulty, where white people, they have done such a phenomenal job confusing us about what racism is, and then they have even disconnected where we don't even connect racism to white people. Like, yes, racism has happened. Folks, good for the moment till we get
yes.
to... Oh, Mr. Demery Ford?
Yes, I had a couple of quick ones. When he was starting school there at Lincoln, you know, they were bringing in female co-eds. And so that was representing a change. And in the book, it said that the general attitude of Lincoln executives were notably animated. Their conversation centered around how necessary it was for black schools to be open to change and how good it was that in spite of when the funds start dropping off because things is not going well, first of all, the school is just for ministers, you know, or, you know, that was the purpose of it, to further brainwash these black people. And then when the contributions start diminishing, then they blame it on the Negroes anyway for just acting a fool on these college campuses. And then one last thing, I had a question. How did Lincoln... what was Lincoln's relationship in the COINTELPRO? He mentioned that in one of his poems. I couldn't find anything on that. I mute my line. Thanks, sir.
I think that is coming up in the rest of the book. He's going the next to make sure I didn't miss an email. But even with that, we can just pick that up after the second audio segment is done. So we will get started. We left off on chapter 16. This is Gil Scott Heron's The Last Holiday, A Memoir, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2. 16. I was not immediately sorry to be at Lincoln. I spent a lot of time from the day I reached Lincoln's campus becoming familiar with the outstanding collection of Black American literature. It took a few days to organize my class schedule and find out where the holes were in my week that would permit extra time among the black stacks in the ancient library. Lincoln had a collection of black books and special editions of literature that were exceeded only by the tremendous amount of material available at the Schomburg on 135th Street in Harlem. In becoming a state-related school, Lincoln had opened itself up to a larger proportion of area students whose fields of interest were a far cry from the course load Thurgood Marshall found to be such a strong foundation for his career as a lawyer. But that material was exactly what I was after. Soon, a lot of the time I was supposed to spend on biology or math I spent at the typewriter
or in that back room where they kept the books too precious to check out. You had to read them there, so that was where I was a lot of the time. Every Wednesday evening, the noted authority in Black American literature, Professor James Saunders Redding, drove up to Lincoln from Washington, D.C., and delivered a 3-hour seminar on the subject. My first year there, I audited his lectures. He did most of his lectures without opening a book. He was a walking repository of Black American literature. He had personally known a lot of the people who had connected me to where I came from creatively. At some stage during my first year, I had the idea for a novel and wanted to write it. I thought I could find the proper rhythm and could balance my schedule between classwork and work on the story, but it proved difficult and I was getting nothing done on the novel. There's a story I heard once about a jackass that was set down squarely between two bales of hay and starved to death. I was just like Jack. When I opened a textbook, I saw the characters from my book. And when I sat at the typewriter, I saw my ass getting kicked out of school for failing all my subjects. Still, in the fall of 1968, I was back on campus having put all of the money I had earned over the summer, plus a small grant from the school to follow up what had been a less than scintillating freshman year. 6 weeks into sophomore year, though, the same thing that had brought my first year crashing down around my ears began to threaten my second. I asked the school for a leave of absence so I could devote myself to writing The Vulture. I would remain on campus for the rest of the semester since I had paid for room and board. I would be at work on the novel and would receive incompletes for all of my classes rather than a complete set of failing grades. That would make it easier to apply for readmission to Lincoln or elsewhere. My advisor was the head of the English department and a thoroughly decent and sympathetic man, but he had no intention of endorsing any plans I had for leaving school to write a book. He respected what writing of mine he had read, but there had been nothing in any of it to suggest to him that I was the next great Black writer to come through Lincoln, and, as he reminded me, the novel is a most difficult form. I knew how difficult it was. That wasn't why I was writing a novel, to show how tough I was. I was simply tired of school. But when the truth wouldn't work, my advisor was not above or below getting rid of some pesky interrogator by assigning him a task somewhere else. The good doctor told me that if I was really serious about leaving Lincoln, the man to see was the dean. The dean reacted to my proposal as though I had taken leave of my senses and asked me to get the school psychiatrist to approve the plan. The dean must have thought I was crazy. It certainly seemed crazy that someone as poor as I was would bet his last money on a first novel. When I told my mother, she said, "Well, I don't think quitting school was the smartest thing you could have done, but go ahead and finish writing it and then come home and get your job. Promise that you'll go back and finish school. You're going to need to go back and you're going to need a degree, okay?" "Yes, ma'am." I really felt good after our talk. She was always able to be both critical and encouraging. My mother had proved, once again, she loved me unconditionally. She had kept her faith in me. Again. I wanted to make her proud of me, and I wanted to prove that she had taken the right tack. She was not unaware of my flawed makeup as a person, nor did she turn a blind eye or ear to the things I lacked as a writer or singer. But her criticism was always constructive and offered in a manner that let me down easy. When she read or heard a problem, she would say things like, "What I might try instead," or "rather than," and avoid just saying something didn't work. That's why I had always taken my ideas, my prose and poetry, my melodies and lyrics to her even before I felt ready to share them or even show them to other family members. I just knew I would learn something from her comments. She gave me another way to look at what I was doing. My mother actually provided the punchline for Whitey on the Moon and also suggested mimicking Langston Hughes by repeating the opening line of the poem, "A Rat Then Bit My Sister Nell," after the bridge-like middle section. When I called my Uncle BB to tell him I was taking time off to write, he jumped all over me. For a family that had sent an entire generation to college, my mother and all her siblings, including BB, I was setting quite another precedent by being the first one of their line to take a sabbatical. I had to stand in the hallway at a payphone listening to him and his opinions on a whole variety of choices I'd made up to that point in my life. The marijuana, the late hours, the guys I chose to hang out with. He saved his worst blows for the last. He spent 5 or 10 minutes that felt like an hour criticizing my style and talent. We were both almost out of breath when he finished. I planned to finish my novel before the start of the second semester in February 1969. That showed how little I knew about what I was doing. By January, I had little more than I had when I saw the university psychiatrist in October and gained his approval. But that month, January, brought me the idea for the ending of the book and a method of connecting the 4 separate narratives to the book's opening. Now all I needed was a chair and my typewriter. That was damn near all I had. For the next 2 months, I worked in a dry cleaner's about a quarter mile from campus. With their business struggling, the owner and his wife both needed to work elsewhere and wanted someone to mind their property and take in and hand out the dry cleaning during the day. A guy in a van stopped by around 6 each evening to pick up what I handed him in a large laundry bag and return finished items previously collected. I slept in the back and took meal money from the small income generated by the students. A few friends would read pages for me, including one student who was a regular customer at the cleaners. They saved me from being pulled into the discouraging blank pages that I faced occasionally when a scene or an idea about the plot, the characters, the connections, something would not work. The experience of writing The Vulture was my way of doing the high wire act blindfolded, knowing that if it didn't work, if it wasn't published, there was no safety net that I could land on and no hole that I could crawl into, no way to face the other folks at Lincoln, and no money to go anywhere else. 17. Since I have lived in the United States of America all my life, I have seen too many deliberate distortions of events and too many slanted pieces of our history and lives to feel that I can correct them all or even put a good-sized dent into them. All I can say is that if the truth is important to you, understand that most things of value have to be worked for, sought out, thought about, and brought about after effort worthy of the great value it will add to your life. It will come at a great price. The time and sweat invested in that pursuit may cost you in hours and days you cannot use in other directions. It may cost you relationships that you would give almost anything else to develop with someone who cannot stand to come in second to anything. The passion with which you commit yourself to something intangible may well turn away the very support that could sustain you. What you will need is help that exceeds understanding. There may be disruptions on every level by those you try to touch, who shy away from you because understanding is not what you are looking for. Your only hope for stability on the levels of togetherness beyond understanding is trust. Anyone who claims to love you knows they will not understand every element of these things you need, and that is where trust must carry you to the rest of the way. The truth you are seeking to write about, to sing about, to make sense of for others is something that you pursue not because you have seen it, but because the spirits tell you it is there. Quitting my classes altogether in October 1968 at the start of my second year at Lincoln was one of those moments in time that test how thoroughly you are trusted beyond understanding. It was one of the active places that all relationships will have to face to overcome before they move securely into love. I hate to get into Oedipus because most of my life I have driven the wrecks. My grandmother would have died again when I quit school, but my mother went there with me. And in April 1969, I had a finished manuscript of The Vulture. I had stayed at the university cleaners, sitting in a folding chair in front of an ancient royal typewriter, and now used 15 of my last $20 to get a bus to New York City. I bluffed my way past a stern, stiff-haired secretary at the front desk of a publishing company and managed to meet the man whose name I had picked up in a magazine, the man who edited Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver, which had been published the year before. I lied and told him he had been recommended to me by people in the organization and presented him with the completed copy of my novel and agreed to come back in 2 weeks. When that day arrived, I was waved right through the reception area to the editor's office, where the person I saw was shuffling through a file cabinet with his back to the door. My heart skipped a beat when I saw my manuscript on his desk. Even upside down, I could read what was written in red ink. Accepted. I was still trying to look like I was on furlough from the organization. I had on a blue dress shirt tucked into pressed black jeans with razor-sharp creases under a zippered black leather jacket. I was carrying an attaché case to look more businesslike than thug. It might have looked like a carrying case for large handguns or a breakdown shotgun, but in it I only had my shaving kit with personal cosmetics. He was into business that day. It was just past noon, but he was looking end of the day. His tie was loosened and his sleeves were rolled up. There was a cigarette burning in an ashtray that held a quarter pack of half-smoked butts, crumpled and twisted. "Hi there, Gil," he said, dropping another stack of folders on his desk. "Have a seat. I've got myself a problem here. A book I thought we had rejected was accepted somehow, and I can't find the contact information for the author. You know how that goes. So many scripts come through." He sat down heavily opposite me at his desk and lit another cigarette. He had a good-sized office with three leather chairs, including his, at angles around a huge ebony desk. With the paperwork and folders scattered across the desk, the open file cabinets, and the fog of cigarette smoke, I felt like I was in a closet. "I went to bat for you on this, Gil," he said, leaning back and making a steeple with his fingers. "It's interesting, but it's not at all what we had expected. We're handling almost 90% nonfiction, especially in, the ethnic arena. A mystery story is a hell of a departure from Soul on Ice. We didn't think it was too smooth to bring you another autobiography right away," I said with a straight face. "A big chance of getting redundant and getting hung up in that cry from the ghetto crap. You know what I mean? It's important that we be seen as well-rounded people who like all kinds of music and literature and all. "Well," he said, fingering the corner of my manuscript, "they're giving me a shot with this on two conditions. Actually, three. Number one is that we can agree on an advance of $2,000. With that, he pushed an envelope forward on his desk. Number two is that we rewrite all the ghetto speak dialogue into English. And number three, we need to switch the order of character number two and character number three. Two sounds too much like one. Do you agree?" He sat back heavily, trying to read what I was thinking. I was too shocked to change expressions. I wasn't deliberately disguising my feelings with a poker face. I found out later what a good idea that was, but at the moment, sitting across from the editor, I was frozen for a minute. What I had just heard was like one of the good news, bad news jokes that were going around at the time. The good news is that there's a check for $2,000. The bad news is that you have to undergo radical surgery to cash that check. I couldn't remember what I had expected just moments before. The most exciting thing to me was that there was a check right in front of me. A huge check with my name on it. I was excited. There was more money sitting there than I had ever seen outside of a bank. There was more than 3 months' pay from all three of the summer jobs I'd worked the previous summer getting together money for Lincoln. That check would cover tuition, room and board, books, everything, even after I gave my mother a 25% commission. The money for the surgery. There must have been a contract somewhere on that desk that would make it official. Cash the check, and what about the surgery? Of the three conditions, two and three were a drag. But if I could talk this man out of two and three, "You want to change character two and character three," I said with a question mark hanging off the end of the sentence. "Well, Junior, character two, is so much like your lead character, Spade, I think the readers will get them crossed. They sound really close in some ways. If you just put three between them," the way that Junior idolized Spade and imitates him and tries so hard to impress him is what I'm playing with, I told him. "The similarities are intentional. I think if I separated them, what I was trying to get across would be lost. Plus the whole mystery thing." "Yeah, you know what?" the editor said, reaching for his cigarettes and giving me a fake smile. "I think our readers are going to be into the ghetto experience more than the mystery angle. I mean, the opening scene with the body, the murder victim, those documents, ha! Those are great literary devices. But what people should be grabbed by is the atmosphere of danger, that something dangerous could happen at any moment." "Well, the atmosphere is all a part of it," I said without any energy. "But I'm not looking at the mystery as secondary. That's what holds it." He cut me off again. I was beginning to see getting interrupted as more a matter of his style than just happenstance. "I know that you authors tend to take everything you write as the Holy Grail, but the most important person in these discussions is the one who isn't here, the reader. That's who the editors represent. I've been at it quite a while and rather successfully." "I'm not questioning your resume," I said, "or the positive contributions you make to your writers. I'm just not that anxious to throw the mystery away." I tried to make it sound like a joke and found a way to smile. "You know, I got two or three bodies I gotta do something with. I just can't leave them laying around the neighborhood." there was a noticeable change in the atmosphere in the room. Things had chilled. As if I needed more proof, the editor began straightening the various folders and papers on his desk. He leaned back in his seat and lit another cigarette. "I'm going to give you time to think about things," he said. "Right here, we have a $2,000 check made out to you. And over here, we have your manuscript. I've been clear about the changes we need to make to get it published. Now you have to decide if you want it published." Yep, that had been pretty clear. I remained seated with my thoughts focused on the $5 bill that was pretty much all I had in my pocket and in the world for that matter. It was so amazing to consider how far things had changed in the year since I had started writing this book. First, I just wanted to see where the idea led me. Then, when I came back to school, I just wanted to have a clear schedule, uncluttered with classes to go to, papers to write, textbooks to read, and exams to take. I quit school for this. All the time, I just wanted to finish something. I had a list of ideas as long as the road from Jackson, Tennessee to West 17th Street, all unfinished and blowing along the highway, scraps of paper, pieces of thoughts I never developed. So, more than I needed to compete with the Hall of Fame school records of my mother and her siblings, more than I needed to stifle the snickers of my Lincoln classmates who called me crazy, I needed to finish one thought. And I had. But since I had never finished anything to speak of, never had anything in print beyond a line or two in this or that school publication, I had never projected my work beyond the hoots and hollers that were tossed my way by Lincoln's hardcore rabble crew, who insisted my disappearance from class was due to my complete dedication to smoking marijuana and that the only writing I did was scribbling apologies to everyone I had lied to when I said I was writing a book. And on this desk in front of me was not only a chance to slap them in their faces, but a check for $2,000. Imagine that. I could walk back onto campus next year, showing off the benefits of a 2 grand advance and have the opportunity to shove copies of a book with my name on it down the throats of the big mouth jokers in front of the student union, guys who'd made me look like a reefer smoking idiot for months, and a chance to see my mother smile and justify her faith and squelch my uncle's scalding critiques. All I had to do was sign that paper and walk out. Walk out and leave my manuscript. Leave my manuscript like leaving a pet at the vet to have it neutered. Leave a deer on the taxidermist's table to have its guts ripped out and replaced with sawdust, its head removed to hang over this smug, smirking egotist's fake apartment fireplace. I tried to add it up again while I sat there feeling cold and clammy, poker-faced like some leather jacket-clad form of dead. I got up slowly with what I'm sure was one of my worst attempts to look like I was smiling. The editor had turned away in his swiveling chair and was concentrating on not looking at me, so he probably didn't see me pick up my manuscript and walk out of his office. 18. People speak in a certain key that's similar to a musical note. When you talk to people naturally, it's comfortable because there's no strain or stress on your vocal cords. Sometimes when people speak too fast or make vocabulary choices that don't ring true, it occurs to me that something is wrong with what they are saying. That was what I heard at the editor's office in New York. I have always told folks that I left with my manuscript that day because of a feeling. I did have a feeling, but I got it from a hearing. That day in the editor's office, I was so full of myself that I might have missed most of the discussion if every word had not been so momentous and magnificent to me. What I missed instead of words was meaning. I heard every word, almost as individual elements, isolated as though they had nothing to do with me or with each other. But I didn't tune in on his meaning until the middle of a solo about Junior imitating Spade. I heard him hit a false note, a note that shouldn't have existed in this conversation. Something like an F flat. There is no such note. Not for a musician. And not from one musician to another. Not from people playing the same tune. The editor wasn't just testing me. There were more notes that didn't belong. His voice went totally out of tune. I can't read minds, but it sounded like he was establishing his domain over a rookie writer who wouldn't be a factor after today. His intention was to hurt, to insult. Not to pay me, but to pay me off. For me to disappear and be grateful for a couple of grand. I took the subway to 23rd Street with some semblance of a plan, pushing its way through alternating pulses of panic. Plan B felt like what it was and what I didn't want it to be, what I had never seen coming, had foolishly not even considered. Here's some other shit I can't talk to anyone about that probably nobody but my mother would believe. An offer of $2,000. An opportunity to have the book published that I had thrown together on a beat-up old Royal typewriter at the University Cleaners. A gritty Manhattan mist felt chilly and uncomfortable on my face and bare head as I emerged on the northeast corner of 23rd, one block west of the bakery where I would spend my remaining dollars before going to 17th Street and taking 10 bucks from my mother's cold cash, a coffee can in the fridge. I would leave her a note, a lie, and catch a bus back to Lincoln. In front of the 23rd Street YMCA, I ran into Freddie Barron, a guy who had been a classmate of mine in Fieldston. He was with his father. It was good to see Freddie, and I always liked his father, too. Freddie and I had played on the football team together our senior year, a team that finished 4-4. My favorite memory of the season was a game in which Freddie and I scored our team's only 2 touchdowns in a 14-8 victory. Freddie scored his when he intercepted a pass from his defensive end position and ran it back 40 yards. Mine was a bit more complicated. I was standing about 10 yards in front of our punt returner, ostensibly to serve as a blocker. The kick, however, was high but short, and the would-be tacklers went past me, angling toward our return man. I fielded the punt and took it back 70 yards past the opposition's massive right tackle. Recollections of high school heroics were a relief at that moment, but none of us was feeling too good about standing there in the rain. The Barons had just finished a workout that included a mile run and a few laps in the pool. They were both flushed and looked fit and healthy, but within the thickening wall of April gloom, they proposed that I join them at their home for dinner and assured me that Mrs. Barron, who I'd also met, would be happy to see me again. I couldn't have sworn I had better plans, so we got on a crosstown bus going east. I caught up with Freddie, heard how unbelievably cold the winters were in Madison, Wisconsin, where he was adjusting to college life. I talked about Lincoln and how I'd finally dropped out of school and what had just happened at the publishing office that day. We had a pleasant dinner and Freddie and I went downstairs to the rec room to play table tennis and shot pool. When we got back to the apartment, Freddie ran directly into the bathroom, and I was about to collapse on the sofa when I saw that Mr. Barron was seated under a reading lamp in the corner with his reading glasses on and my manuscript in his lap. He read on for a few minutes after I took a seat near him. Then he closed it up and put it carefully back in the plastic cover. He smiled, folded his glasses carefully, and put them back in their case. Of all the Fieldston parents, he had always been the most approachable, the most available to drive guys to a band rehearsal or stand on the sidelines alone to watch a lightly attended football game. He spoke with my mother fairly often. I had stayed at their house a few times, too. The Barons lived in Stuyvesant Town on East 23rd Street, which was practically next door to West 17th by Manhattan standards. "Gilbert," he said in his rich baritone, "I've read about 40 pages here, and I must admit I don't know a lot about the life you are describing, but I know more than I did because you know it so well. I've got two friends who write commercials, and they're always talking about the art of telling a story in 1 minute. That's what they do. I'd like to show this to them and see if they couldn't put a few things in the margins." When he stopped, Mr. Barron took a furtive look toward the bathroom, reached into his breast pocket, and pulled out a $50 bill and handed it to me. I understood that he didn't want Freddie involved, but I hadn't said anything about the current state of my finances. I appreciated his perception. "Look," I said hastily, "I've got a tax refund due." He cut me off. "No," he said seriously. "Let me tell you a story. When I was just getting started, I almost didn't make it. I had a rented space and I had my whole line of dresses and everything there. I had made arrangements for everything to go out. Most of the pieces had been ordered and I was confident that they would be moved. But my rent was due on the warehouse, and if I paid it, I wouldn't have money left to ship the pieces out, and all of my outlets had 30 and 45 day leads before money would be coming in. I had cut every corner imaginable, and it just wasn't going to happen. It was about midnight, and I was writing my landlord a note about getting everything out of there and a little about what else had happened when I saw him walking down the hall. When he saw my light on, he stopped by. Mr. Barron said the landlord came to his space and, after hearing the situation, told him to hold off on paying the rent, said they could work it out when the money started coming in. I tell you, Gilbert, I'd only talked to the man when I rented the space and seen him a few times going in and out. Very businesslike, short on conversation. But he raised my spirits, and I never forgot what he said then. If you ever get a chance to help someone else get started, do that for me and tell them to pass it on. Then he waved and was off again. I believe in that, Gilbert. I don't want this back, but I do want you to remember it and pass it on. Mr. Barron smiled and got up. I'm going to hand this over to my friends and have them get in touch with you at this number. The number on the manuscript was the payphone at the diner across Route 1 from the dry cleaners where I worked. I still felt washed out, but the kind of help Mr. Barron gave me was help in its purest form when somebody does something for you for nothing. But I still intended to get him back that money in 2 weeks, three at the outside. About 10 days later, before I'd had a chance to square that debt, I was wrestling with the day's dry cleaning load when the niece of the owner of the diner called me from across the street. "It's the telephone spotter," she said in her soprano. It's a call from New York. The lady on the phone was named Lynn Nesbitt. She was a literary agent with a firm on the Avenue of the Americas. A week before, a friend had dropped a manuscript by and asked her to take a look. She had read it all in one sitting. The following day, she'd shown it to a friend at World Publishing. They agreed that it needed some work. "But would you be willing to accept $5,000 as an advance?" she asked. "I don't remember whether I accepted before or after I fainted." Whichever it was, I agreed to meet Lynn Nesbitt in her office in 3 days. I was so happy I could have peed in my pants. World Publishing also bought the rights to Small Talk at 125th and Lenox, a volume of poetry released simultaneously with The Vulture. That one I dedicated to my mother because she always appreciated the poetry so much and had helped me with some of the lines and ideas. The novel I dedicated to Mr. Jerome Barron, without whom The Bird would never have gotten off the ground. And I have tried to follow his advice and pass it on every time I have the opportunity. Context of White Supremacy. That will wrap us for this week's session. We'll be back next week, same broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, for Gil Scott Heron's The Last Holiday. The chapter will pick up on chapter 19. Chapter 19 is what we'll pick up at for next Friday. Folks would like to participate, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Let's see, all the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Lines should be open. Make sure we don't have anybody that we missed completely. I don't think there's anybody that we missed totally, the first time around. So the folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free if you have commentary you would like to share. Folks have commentary from the second audio segment. Nothing stood out in particular. Oh, the caller at 3637. We hadn't heard from you. 3637. Did you have commentary?
I'm sorry about that. Hi, everyone. I was, hello, this is Clayton the 712. And I was able to listen to the second reading. I didn't get to listen to the first one. But it was making me think about how hard it must be for Black writers to get anything done when you have a constant wall of racist, white supremacist, suspect editors that'll just come and tell you, you know, this isn't good enough, you got to take this out, and you need to put this in and take this out. And I just thought about that because I was thinking about dabbling in writing, but I don't know, I just feel like I get blocked by editors, but you really want that stuff published, and I don't know if there's any way around it. But that's what stood out the most to me, the editors and making it difficult for Black people to write honestly, or even if they're writing, you know, fiction, throw some honesty in there. I just think it would be hard because you would get roadblocked by those editors. And that's all I wanted to say. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. Great point. I generally write something very similar to that when I post any articles that I have published, that it's very, very hard for Black writers, particularly if you're trying to write about racism. It is very difficult, directly, indirectly, because of white people. Sometimes it might even be that it's all Black people, but you still have to factor in white people. Somehow, some way, racism ends up being a big hindrance to being able to write black for black authors. Other folks who dialed in, they had commentary. Line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Just wanted to add, I definitely want to kind of give a huge shout out of self-respect in reference to, you know, just going through the counselors doubting him, the dean doubting him, and then sending him to a psychiatrist, almost kind of putting him in this place of not even being mentally fit to make a decision like he was making. And as we all know, if he was a white individual kind of putting this out there, he probably would have received a ton of support, go at it, maybe even given some resources to kind of push forward in this area. But for him to kind of go through all that he went through, kind of even endure all that he had to do while writing, as he talked about, you know, the environment that he had to write in, working, and then sit down in front of this editor the first time ever going through this, and then be offered a $2,000 check that would have literally changed his dynamic, and passing that up. And I think, as I think about all of the individuals today, the rappers that are kind of going in front of these individual companies and taking whatever, you know, just to kind of get noticed, and then getting these deals that are just kind of doing horrible things for themselves and for the communities. Him sticking to his, just sticking to his kind of moral compass and saying, you know what, this doesn't feel right, even though the money would have been amazing for him at that time and changed so many things. And like you said, putting that, look at what I did in front of everybody who doubted him, and would have gotten all the praise from everyone, to pass that up. Again, just kind of really took my hat off to that whole situation. And then at the end, was able to kind of really get more than double of the offer, and then even some additional pieces. So that was really amazing in terms of just kind of reading it from that perspective. And again, like I said, just knowing what he probably would have been offered if he wasn't a non-white person kind of in the same situation, just kind of really speaks to his determination. So that kind of stood out. And I have some more notes that I'm taking down, but I'll kind of mute my line and come back.
Appreciate that. Do we have other folks who dialed in who had a hand up, who had commentary they wanted to share, second half of the last holiday? Any other hands up that we, from folks who had commentary? Right on. I'll get out. Oh, was someone going to speak, or?
I was just thinking, someone would say, well, you know, that's what editors do. They, go about the means of, giving suggestions, just like what he's writing about on what the comments that the guy was saying. But I don't know if I would think that it's not many white aspiring writers that have to go to a black person to edit and pick out and nitpick their works. So it makes it very difficult and very different. And as one of the callers stated, this is what we witnessed. We witnessed when our talented young artists of different gentries, whether it's music or whatever, goes to these people, and they twisted. Pick at it and basically tell them that if they're putting something constructive, then they definitely going to try to change it, especially if it's something about racism. and make it something that is negative and not constructive. And we hear and see it often as a finished product. That's why so many white people be buying the music, in my mind, as far as from a musical standpoint, so-called music anyway. To me, some of the things that I hear is noise as opposed to music. But nevertheless, the finished product, it goes through white editors. And that was a act of self-respect by just, you know, $2,000, the money, which was a lot for him, and that, not just for him, from anybody his age at that point in time and what they were into as far as college and that sort of thing. And he showed a tremendous amount of self-respect by turning it down because he had more respect for his artistry as opposed to being paid off, so to speak, to accept changes to his work. So I thought that was great. And that's more than likely one of the reasons why I always admired him in the first place. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. other folks, we have anybody else that had commentary that they wanted to get in? Right on. I'll share some of my thoughts, and then we'll check in, see if other folks have anything that they want to share from this. So we're starting at 16. COINTELPRO is going to come up again. I know it didn't come up in this section in terms of Mr. Demery Ford's question specifically about COINTELPRO at Lincoln University. That was not in this section, but I do know COINTELPRO is going to come up again in the book, so we'll have to pay attention to see if it's specifically about Lincoln. From the segment, I would think at this time, I mean, I would think even now, right, 2017, if you are a black, maybe, I don't know, 20-year-old, and you're supposed to be at college, and you tell your parents, like, I'm going to drop out of school so I can write a book, like, I don't know. I mean, even now, I can't imagine too many folks saying, yeah, that's a sensible plan. That's going to work. I think you'll be able to crank out, you know, a bestseller, or at least something where you'll, you know, be able to make, I don't know, what a reasonable amount of money would be for a book where you can make, I don't know, $50,000 maybe, I don't know, something like that. So to do this in the 60s, like, wow. I'm sure it might be even understated where he was saying, like, he went to, like, the dean and such, and they advised him to go see the psychiatrist, thought he had, you know, lost his mind, and, you know, his Uncle BB is admonishing him for this and what have you. Like, I suspect it might be undersold. Like, I would have think it would have been, this is about the most impractical use of time and energy imaginable for you to write some goofy book. To drop out of school, no less, to do it. Like, wow. Or to pause your education at all. The boldness, though, I definitely respect that type of boldness to say this is what I want to do. And, you know, I'm willing to take the risk. I'm serious about it, to invest the time and energy in my writing. Definitely respect that. Writing is more, reading and writing, more important than watching television. Let's see. So he goes through the protocol. He does what he's supposed to do. You know, he faces down his family and everything to continue with his writing in this laundry, no less. So he gets the vulture. He gets it written and it gets accepted. And then he goes and he has a meeting with another individual that I suspect is a race soldier. So he's in here. He's talking to this guy. $2,000, and same thing that you all have said, the black self-respect. I mean, imagine that. You've got, I think you said he had like $5 to his name. Somebody gives you a check for $2,000. I'll publish your book, $2,000, make these changes with the character and clean up your sloppy, you know, Negro dialect, and we got a deal. And I say, no, I'm not going to do it. And further, his reading of this guy, where he's saying, you know, I think this guy was just trying to, you know, just get one over on me. Like, you know, this is just some dumb nigga writer, and, you know, I'm going to set him straight and show him how it is in the business that, you know, I'm the man, I'm in charge. We say what goes. We get to decide what's going to be authentic black writing and all of that. And just say, no, this is, you know, my vision for what I want the vulture to be. And, you know, I'll take my $5 and my manuscript, and I will leave you your $2,000 check, and then to hear the way that it worked out, like, wow, that is just amazing. And again, I think black self-respect even reminds me of Mr. Fuller. I think on one of his visits to the program, he said that you can get assistance, you can get help, but it would be in the direction that you're going. So if you're trying to publish and you keep at it, your persistence, that, hey, sometimes the universe will work with you to get help in that direction. But also if it's something non-constructive, that, yep, you can get help in doing that too. Also, thinking of Mr. Fuller, man, that passage when he describes like this thought process and his feelings, thoughts around turning down $2,000 to, you know, take his little manuscript and be broke and, you know, just continue to see if he could get it published someplace else. And when he explained, I mean, wow, I thought of Mr. Fuller, this whole little passage here where he says that he never had anything published beyond a line or two in the school publication, never had projected my work beyond the hoots and hollers that were tossed my way by Lincoln's hardcore rabble crew who insisted my disappearance from class was due to my complete dedication to smoking marijuana. Sobriety would be best. And that the only writing I did was scribbling apologies to everyone I had lied to when I said I was writing a book. And on this desk in front of me was not only a chance to slap them in their faces, but a check for $2,000. Imagine that. I could walk back onto campus next year showing the benefits of a $2,000 advance and have the opportunity to shove copies of a book with my name on it down the throats of the big mouth jokers in front of the student union guys who'd made me look like a reefer smoking idiot for months, and a chance to see my mother smile and justify her faith and squelch my uncle's scalding critiques. All I had to do was sign that paper and walk out. In my opinion, great passage, great piece of very detailed writing about what was happening in his thought process around rejecting this $2,000. This, I mean, the moment that I read it, I don't highlight when I read the book. I'll just kind of make a mental note of things as I'm reading it to do the narration. And then when we do the book study session, I'll remember the things that stood out, and even new things will stand out. But immediately I thought when Mr. Fuller said the system of white supremacy, one of the major products of that system is black people having a very low level of ambition, show-offism. It's what he's got in his writing, his counter-racist literature, where he says that we have made, not all of us, but a lot of us, too many of us, as a result of being victims of white supremacy, we have made our primary ambition to get back at the rabble crew, to get back at other black people that talked bad about us and said we were nothing. I mean, man, the detail was so specific. Like, you know, there was some genuine pain there, I guess, feeling like they had mocked him and, you know, Gil, you're just some idiot. You're high all the time and you haven't even written anything, calling yourself a writer and, you know, whatever else was being said to him. But I mean, that is incredible that is the motivation that I want to get a book so then I can go and shove it in all these black people's faces who told me I was nothing. Like, show off. And what does Mr. Fuller say? Okay, so you write your book, you get $2,000, say you get $5,000, say you get $10,000, so you get to go around and shove it in all the black people's faces. Here's my book and here's my check, and you don't even have 2 cents to rub together, and I got $10,000. You get to shove. Okay, now what? What's act two? What's act three? And meanwhile, racists are sitting back and laughing at all of us. It was a white man. We get to see that. A white person directly who signed the check to give you the few coins that you have to brag about. I mean, it was a stunning illustration to just see that pop up. That was instantaneously what popped into mind. Mr. Fuller talking about show-offism. This is what the system of white supremacy encourages in non-white people. Continuing. The whole scene where he meets up with his friend from high school and his father, Mr. Barron, Freddie Barron, his friend, who'd been a classmate of his at Fieldston. So they go to the guy's house and he's reading over the manuscript, like, wow, just being able to get a bit of assistance. In fact, let me make sure Mr. Barron is do y'all think these people are black? Let me make sure. I thought they were black people. The Barons are black. Yes. Anybody think the Barons are white people?
I thought they were black.
Okay.
I'm going to read back again, see if I didn't miss anything.
Yeah, me too. I'm just trying to make sure. I thought he said that they were, that these were black people. I'm just trying to make sure that I didn't botch that or come to a, I feel like he would have maybe said that explicitly, that these were white people. So yeah, great. Unless somebody points out that that is not the case, that these are white people, I'm going to go that the Barons are black. So for the black family and what they did helping him out, just tremendous. This reminded me, there is a like scholarly report that talks about philanthropy and how a lot of times when people think of who helps out, like who helps out the quote unquote less fortunate, they think of white people like the Rockefellers or the Gates or what have you. And they were saying that a lot of times black people are huge philanthropists, but they don't get credit for it because they don't do it in a way where it's not, oh, I'm going to write $1 million check to this foundation or get this whole wing named after me or this library. But you know, there is a lot of what we saw from Mr. Barron. Lots of that does not get credit. And I just thought, like, wow, like, and particularly with the timing of all that, to just walk away from $2,000 and to be feeling that low and to then get that. So I think he might even say that might be the spirits intervening to make sure that, you know, he's sustained and to know that he's doing the correct thing, exercising black self-respect and authority authorship. Over his written word. But I thought that was great. I thought that was black self-respect, black people helping another black person. He didn't even say that, you know, my finances are in a tough spot, or he didn't go there begging for a meal or a few coins or anything. Just seeing a black person, I'm going to see if I can help, and I'm going to see if I can pass your manuscript off to some of my friends. Maybe they can offer a helpful tip or what have you. I just thought that was tremendous. Let's see what... another. Oh, yeah. At the beginning of the chapter, I thought it was also important when he talked about listening to the way that people talk, listening to what they say. Obviously, for a program like this, I thought that was super important as well. And listening just to when he says, sometimes when people speak too fast or make vocabulary choices that don't ring true, it occurs to me that something is wrong with what they are saying. I think that's very important. And particularly when we're dealing with master deceivers like whites, I think that is super important that we are alert to those sorts of signals, cues, and take them seriously. I'll stop there. Did other folks have a commentary that stood out from the second audio segment? Anything else that they wanted to share? Folks satisfied? Nothing else in particular stood out? Section number two? I'll assume folks are satisfied. I am looking forward as this accelerates, because we really haven't. I've kind of been paying attention to that. We really haven't heard a whole lot about Stevie Wonder, or not Stevie Wonder, well, him too, but we haven't heard a whole lot about Dr. King. I don't think either of those two were mentioned in this week's section, right? Stevie Wonder, Dr. King. Even if I'm had to go back to last week, or I guess we did get a quick mention of Stevie Wonder and saying that he was going to play one of Stevie Wonder's tunes on the Steinway before Mr. Werthmann busted him. But I mean, that was just kind of a quick reference. But I don't think there was any detail about either Dr. King or Stevie Wonder last week. So I'm curious as to how all of that will accelerate in the text. As I said, COINTELPRO is going to come back into the text, so we can pay attention to that as we proceed as well. But looking forward, enjoying it. Always a big fan of autobiographies. I am still trying to figure out, there's some sort of technical issue causing some disruption, and it seems to be isolated to the TuneIn feed. So for the people that are listening online at TuneIn or Black Talk Radio, there's some sort of intermittent disturbance. I'm not sure where it's emanating from, because I don't hear it. It's not on. If you're listening via the people that dialed in via the phone line, I suspect that they're not able to hear it. I'm not able to hear it. It seems to just be on the stream. And I'm having a very difficult time locating where exactly the source of the disturbance is coming from. So I'm going to see if I can work on that and get that corrected before we broadcast tomorrow. If folks have any thoughts around that or tips, that'd be great. You can drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have suggestions thoughts for future guests, or if you have problems finding a program in the archives, if you have other problems, gripes, untiljustice@gmail.com. Feel free to drop an email. We'll be here tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific for the compensatory call-in. We'll catch up on what's gone down the last 7 days. And as I stated, Dr. Tommy Curry will be here on Tuesday. We'll discuss his new book, The Man Not. I've been reading that this week. It has been a fascinating read. It will be great to have him back on the program to go in detail. And I think this will be the first time that we will have Dr. Curry on the program since we read The Delectable Negro. So people who participated in that book study session should have questions, anything that stuck out. If you want an opportunity, since Dr. Curry recommended that we read that text, you should have your questions ready to roll Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. Hopefully, again, we'll get the tech issues resolved to make it a little easier for people to listen via TuneIn or Black Talk Radio Network for the live feed. Thanks again. I hope folks will be safe, codified for the weekend. It was a beautiful, lovely summer day here in the Pacific Northwest. I hope you got the same wherever you happen to be on the planet. Get out, frolic, enjoy the sunshine. That does not mean be relaxed in your codification. Racists, they do not stop terrorizing black people just because the weather is nice. I think sobriety should be a part of that code. Mr. Scott Heron had a lot of substance abuse issues in his life, well-documented substance abuse issues. In my view, us being under the influence, that has not helped us solve this problem at all. And if anything, there are a lot of times, there's a lot of evidence where racists, they have had an even easier time terrorizing and dominating us because we were intoxicated. We were not in our right mind, not able to make the best decisions to neutralize racist man, racist woman, racist child. Sobriety should be a central aspect to counter racist codification. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.